Thank you. I'm Alan Fletcher. I'm president of the Aspen Music Festival and School. Welcome to High Notes in week 5 of the 2019 season. We're grateful to Aspen Public Radio for being our broadcast partner, and this will be broadcast at 2 p.m. on Thursday, tomorrow, and also available on the Aspen Public Radio website and on our website at any time. I'm delighted to have with me on stage Alyssa Weilerstein, Enon Barnaton, and Colin Curry. If you studied your calendar, you will say, where is Sergei Khachaturian? And Sergei was not able to make it to Aspen for his performances this week, but he is going to, his part will be played by a wonderful violinist, Philippe Quint. Perhaps it's indiscreet of me to say, but Philippe agreed very graciously and bravely to step into this international tour, which is going on, and decided he would rather practice than be with us at this moment. So, in any case, Asadora Centurion said, I think Alyssa and Enon and Colin will be able to carry the day. So, I'm going to first do some introductions, and Alyssa is in the category in Aspen of someone who needs no introduction, but it's fun to say nice things about her, so I will, not in any particular order, but she is the recipient of a MacArthur Fellowship in recognition of her extraordinary thoughtfulness and spirit of inquiry into the repertoire. Graduate of the Cleveland Institute and also with a degree in history from Columbia University. Winner of the Leonard Bernstein Prize, this Leonard Bernstein Prize given by the Schleswig-Holstein Festival. The first time they gave it was to Long Long. Later they gave it to Licia Batyashvili, later to Jonathan Biss, and the first time ever given to a cellist, to Alyssa. Also the Avery Fisher Career Grant. Also, I have about 7 cards that go on and on with these things. I thought I would mention something, and you can take my thought for what it is or what it isn't. Virgil in the Aeneid has Aeneas say to Dido, there is no greater misery than to recall a time of happiness in a time of unhappiness. With that in mind, I thought Alyssa might tell us a little about her visit, invited by Michelle Obama to the White House for a wonderful series of days of seminars thinking about music and children.
You really are making me miserable now. No, it was a beautiful day, and it was a wonderful initiative that the former First Lady did. She actually had a jazz event, and I think even a rock and also country music event, and then there was a classical music day. And so there were 4 musicians, including myself. There was Joshua Bell came, and Sharon Isbin, who is very familiar to Aspen audiences as well, and Avadajan Pratt, the wonderful pianist. And we spent the day basically giving some classes to kids who were invited from various schools around the DC area. And then we gave a concert at the end for President Obama and the First Lady. And it was in kind of an audience of about 200 people. And this was really quite wonderful, actually. So, yeah.
Well, lovely. I will turn to Enon Barnaton, also very familiar and beloved to our audience in Aspen. Also a recipient of the Avery Fisher Career Prize, also from Lincoln Center, the Martin Siegel Award, which is a very significant award for an artist emerging into a major career. Also recently named Artistic Director of the La Jolla Music Society's Summerfest. And Enon will, I believe, go from here to La Jolla and has a really brilliant program planned for his inaugural period. And we're going to get to that, I think, a little later. I'd love to talk about that more. I thought I would mention, because we're in our 70th anniversary season and thinking about our own history, that Enon's latest recording is of Messiaen's great, massive work, Des Canyons aux Étoiles. And Messiaen was here in the 1950s, and in fact, it was on trips that he made to the American West as part of that period in his life that he was inspired to write this work. So rush to Amazon.com or to your nearest real store and buy that recording. Also notable, I have down here, is Enon's cycle of all the Beethoven concertos, which is with Alan Gilbert and St. Martin in the Fields. And that is timely for us as we enter into next season, which is going to be a Beethoven anniversary season. So make sure, Enon, that we talk about your evolution idea, because that's going to be very applicable to our season next year. Also with us today is Colin Curry. This is not Colin's first time in Aspen. He was here with us on a Chris Rouse project. Do you recall what year that was?
I was just working that out the other day, I think 2011.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, fantastic. Colin, born in Scotland, was the first percussionist to be a finalist for the BBC Young Musician of the Year Award, and then did win Royal Philharmonic Society's Young Artist of the Year. He has won a Grammy Award for his performance of Jennifer Higdon's percussion concerto, is on the faculty of the Royal Academy in London and also the Royal Conservatoire in The Hague, and has also founded the Colin Curry Group, which specializes in the music of Steve Reich, but I think also a lot of contemporary important work. And we're delighted that you're back with us. So the three of you are on an international tour with the repertoire that you'll be playing this evening. Is that correct?
Tomorrow evening,
okay. Yes. Sorry.
You scared us.
I think I better run down the concerts involved here so I don't make that mistake again. Tomorrow evening, Colin and Enon and Alyssa and Philippe perform in Harris Hall on a recital at 8 o'clock. Yes, okay. That is Thursday. Colin is also playing on our Saturday chamber music concert, which is 4:30 p.m. in Harris Hall. And what will that repertoire be?
I'm about to have my first rehearsal for that. I'm teaming up with three of the percussion students, and we're doing a work by Steve Reich, who you've just mentioned there. It's a composer I'm very close with, and we are putting together a work for four percussionists by him, which is his Mallet Quartet.
Fantastic. Then Enon plays with the Aspen Chamber Symphony on Friday at 6 p.m. This is the Barber Piano Concerto, and we'll talk about that piece in a moment. And then Alyssa is with the Aspen Festival Orchestra on Sunday, and that is at 4 p.m. with the Samuel Barber Cello Concerto, and we'll have a little conversation about that as well. Tomorrow evening, the program opens with Beethoven's Ghost Trio, and I thought we would start, so this will not involve Colin, although, you know, Colin may represent this sort of phantasm, this is really one of the central works in the trio repertoire. Alyssa, as you will well know, has toured the world with her parents, Vivian Weilerstein and Donald Weilerstein, in the Weilerstein Trio. So you've no doubt played the Ghost Trio since you were a teenager. But it's not my principal subject today, but I just thought we would talk a little about that work. It's in the very center of Beethoven's works and was a quite important work to Beethoven.
Yeah. In a way, I mean, this is Opus 70, so it's really, as you say, just right in the middle, Opus 70, number one. And it wasn't originally, of course, entitled The Ghost, but The Ghost actually refers to the incredible mysticism and character in this very, very dark mood of the second movement, which is, it's kind of a gateway into some of the late Beethoven, which is much more existential and more groundbreaking kind of harmonically and even in terms of form. It's not in any way a conventional trio form, especially not for the time. The second movement is really it's the heart of the trio, which is then sandwiched in between these very, very light, buoyant and exuberant movements. And actually in this program, it's really the only time that you hear anything that's really just genuinely joyful, because the rest of the program is actually quite dark. So extremely dark in the Shostakovich Symphony, which we'll get to. But We thought that when we were constructing the program, which originally also included Schoenberg's Bekleidete Nacht, which refers to Transfigured Night, we thought that it was the perfect segue to have this kind of supernatural, searching quality to get us right into the mood of the Schoenberg, and then to culminate with the Shostakovich. But even in this new iteration of the program, which you'll hear tomorrow, it fits extremely well with the rest of the repertoire.
Okay.
Yeah, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong, but one of the reasons also that it's called a ghost, and one of the story that associated with it is that there's at the same time Beethoven was working on a possible opera on Macbeth, and some of that material was found and was also known to have mentioned Macbeth in relation to that particular movement. So the ghost of Macbeth is somewhat said to be hovering above that second movement. And there's this extraordinary second movement that's, I guess, is magical realism.
Yeah. The other work that I'm putting in tomorrow evening is by Rolf Wallin, a Norwegian composer. It's a suite of marimba pieces called the Realismos Magicos, and these are a short suite of short pieces for solo marimba, in which the magical realism of Gabriel Garcia Marquez, and particularly the titles from a collection of short stories, have musical evocations. And there's certainly very much in that sort of hinterland, the nether world of the magical realisms, sort of slightly one foot in this world, one foot in the next, and maybe your head somewhere else altogether. So very, very kind of evocative and thought-provoking music, kind of a contemporary slant on the other music that's in the program. I think it all fits together very well.
Yeah, and in some ways it's one of the threads that goes through the program is it's looking back at other works, and in Beethoven's case, Macbeth, and here we were talking about Marquez, and in Shostakovich's case, right, looking back at a lifetime of his own music making as well as other composers, and quoting and referring to a lot of music that came before him, and reflecting at the end of his life on a world and then a lifetime of music.
Right.
So a little personal brush with greatness. I had one of my undergrad teachers was Lewis Lockwood, who was then president of the International Beethoven Society. And he knew that the manuscript to the Ghost Trio is in the Morgan Library in New York. And he also knew that the second movement, Beethoven in sketching, first of all, he sketched a lot. And a very common thing is he would do a single cross out of something he had written and write schlecht in the margin, bad. And then you could see what he rewrote or wrote later. And for instance, the melody that is the choral finale in the Ninth Symphony, there are, I think, 24 versions of it in the sketchbooks. And when you look at the previous versions, you think, yeah, schlecht. it gets better and better. But in the second movement of the Ghost Trio, he did something he did not do otherwise. He completely blackened a whole page of manuscript with his pencil so that you cannot see it. And so Mr. Lockwood's challenge to me was to figure out what was underneath that. And we made a photograph and printed it on semi-transparent paper and first literally looked through it to get clues. And then the Morgan Library amazingly let me have the actual page and look at it front and back and look at the indentations and try to figure out what was there. In the end, I don't want to disappoint you, but the final version is way better.
He knew what he was doing.
Yeah, there's a reason he blacked it, yes, I guess.
Exactly. Anyway. Let's go to the Shostakovich that'll be on tomorrow night's program. So I did want to clarify, as Alyssa already said, the published program includes a version made by Edward Steuermann, who was a very close associate of Schoenberg, of the Verklärte Nacht, which is a string sextet, but a version for trio. And there are many reasons why we would love to hear that, but we're just not going to tomorrow. And one of my associates in the office said, people will be so angry. I said, oh yes, we took off a Schoenberg piece, but it is a gorgeous work, and someday I hope we will have it.
Absolutely.
We couldn't ask Philip to asking him to fill in the short notice on the Shostakovich is enough, and then to ask him to also do Schoenberg, which is incredibly tricky as well, was too much. So, but that Schoenberg is one of my personal favorite pieces, and for me, the chance to actually play it. Because it's normally played by strings, and to actually be able to play that piece was such an incredible experience that
to a percussionist and a cellist, and you're complaining about your lack of repertoire. It's pretty rich coming from a pianist.
I'm complaining about the lack of a specific repertoire.
You don't have it right. I'm
fair enough.
Okay, so Shostakovich, this is his 15th symphony, that is thus his final symphonic work, written in 1971, arranged for a quartet, percussionist, violinist, cellist, pianist. And I would observe that this symphony has a particularly important percussion part throughout, but especially the first and last movements. The last movement is virtually a percussion concerto already when you hear the symphonic version. In the middle is a very important cello solo, and of course the cello was a key instrument in all of Shostakovich's works. There is no piano part in the symphony, so I don't know what you're doing.
There's no what? Oh,
piano part.
Yes. I'm doing everything else.
it's an enormous, fantastic, virtuosic part in the piano part. Okay.
How did this work come about? Who did it? Why?
First of all, just to mention that the instrumentation for this particular arrangement is for piano trio and percussion section, of which Collins is the most prominent. But there are three different percussionists, because the percussion part from the symphony is virtually unchanged. And in the symphony, I believe it takes five or six people to play it, and now they have to manage with just three. But Colin has the strength of seven men. So this particular arrangement, which is an incredible arrangement, because the symphony is not a normal symphony for Shostakovich in many, many ways. It's his most enigmatic, but also in terms of the writing, it has a lot of intimacy and a lot of chamber. Even in the full orchestral version, a lot of chamber qualities and intimate qualities, which made it very, very suitable for an arrangement, which actually, strangely, Alisa found this arrangement and brought it to my attention. I say strangely because it was done by my piano teacher in Israel. My piano teacher, Victor Dervianko, that I say was in Israel, who was a close friend of Shostakovich's, and did it with his blessing. Made that arrangement that I wasn't aware of. So the fact that she brought it to my attention was kind of fortuitous. When I looked at the name, I said, Derofianko? No way.
It's true. Yeah. I remember your surprise with that. That was, it's incredible, fantastic, very happy coincidence. And he's aware that we've done it, right?
He's thrilled.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
And so, Colin, what adjustments do you make in terms of setup, in terms of are you playing everything and
Well, I'd known this symphony as a Shostakovich lover from my teenage years, and I'd always known that the 15th symphony had really a percussion feature or focus. And spoilers aside, the end of this symphony is unmistakable and unforgettable. And if it works, it's truly harrowing, astounding, heart-stopping, heartbreaking, perhaps. And in fact, this is all re-achieved with percussion. There are, in the symphonic version, there are various parts. So the instruments used are the timpani, which is the main thing that I'll be playing. But then there are very important parts for the tuned percussion, xylophone, glockenspiel. And there's an important vibraphone solo at one point. And then there's also the kind of the toys, if you like, which are kind of treated like clockwork, and machine-like qualities of these instruments are harnessed to this amazing effect, which you will hear. Snare drum, castanets, woodblock, triangle. So things you would expect to hear, I would say, in regular percussion section, but used in an unmistakable way. There had already been snapshots of this kind of writing in his repertoire, including the second cello concerto, where you get this kind of this kind of very kind of sotto voce lines of percussion that just go and just hold you in a trance, if you like. So there's quite a lot of that in this piece. It's also used in the Fourth Symphony, which is, I think, in Shostakovich's output, maybe the twin of the 15th Symphony, because they're both very free, if you like, involving a lot of through-composed sections and a great freedom with the structure. And to achieve the intimacy needed in this version, I think it rightly was probably felt by David Yanko that to have a whole percussion sitting there, you know, five percussionists would probably be a bit over the odds. So he's managed to make it, although it's a little bit of a fiddle and there are quite a few quick changes, there are actually three of us juggling, sometimes literally juggling it's all these parts.
Say again? Is it 13 instruments, is it?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Sounds right, yeah. Yeah. Bass drum, tam-tam, yeah, you know, many, many things. Yeah. But very, very important, and I think a key component of the piece. Indeed, in making this arrangement, I think you can buy that there is no brass anymore, no woodwinds. But to have this symphony without percussion would never work. I mean, you could never have that. No. So it's a joy to do. I think it really, really works because it feels like both things. It definitely feels like a symphony. It feels like a big symphonic experience. But yet it's this intimacy of the chamber music right from the beginning to end. So it's a brilliant thing. Yeah. It really is.
And I mean, I think I can speak for all of us. We all really adore playing this piece. It's deeply satisfying, and to have, as Colin said, this symphonic experience. But something which always really moved me about Lee Shostakovich, and which this piece has very much in common with the second cello concerto, it's largely very existential. Mm. And you know, let's say that the general mood of the the pieces is quite dark. I mean, any kind of scherzo is just very black humor and everything. But in addition to the incredible percussion concerto, basically at the very end of both pieces, something else that this has in common very much is a kind of window of at the very end of the piece, a kind of window of light. Which I personally feel is finally not ironic, even if anything else, it was even in a major key, was very ironic before. It's, well, could it be? Could there be some kind of hope or something positive? And then there's a crash. Absolutely not. No, this is absolutely negative and a very dark worldview. But it's deeply, deeply moving, and I remember the first couple of times that we played it, I actually found it very, very hard to speak to anyone afterwards. I was just very, it was very hard to get out of this mindset, which is so powerful and so really, really quite, as dark as the music is, it's really quite wonderful to experience and to play. Yeah. And to listen to as well.
Absolutely. And one of the things, David Lynch is said to have been really inspired by this symphony to create the Blue Velvet, if everybody's seen that movie. And he told whoever was writing the soundtrack, the main theme, to be directly instructed them to be directly inspired by the symphony. And to some extent, the symphony has a very David Lynchian sensibility, where it's never quite one thing or another. It's never quite humorous or quite tragic. It's always, there's this surreal dichotomy. And in that way, this sense of enigmatic mystery is, for example, in the first movement, many times throughout the movement, he quotes the theme from William Tell Overture. And he quotes...
Six times.
Yeah. And he quotes Wagner, he quotes Rachmaninoff, he quotes a lot of different things during the piece.
He quotes himself as well.
He quotes himself. And people asked him why the quotes. And he said, I honestly don't know. but I couldn't not include them. But I think there is a sense of displacement that happens when that happens, where you're thinking this surrealism of this alternate reality. Is this mm-hmm. is it this thing or is it another that goes throughout this entire symphony? That's quite fascinating.
So, Alyssa, tell us about the cello writing. I was going to say that from the time he met Rostropovich, cello was so important, but Shostakovich was actually writing the piano trio when he met Rostropovich, so it was already in his mind. But then you've played all of the Shostakovich works. Mm-hmm. How do you see this? And aside from the cello part, which is so important in the symphony, what else do you do?
Well, I mean, I think this is actually, it's not just unique to the cello part, it's all of us, because we are, as we were saying, compressing the symphony into piano trio and percussion. And so kind of do everything. And in fact, the William Tell quotes, I think it's trumpets in the symphony version, and actually the cello plays 5 out of the 6 of them. So the cello becomes, the cello plays a lot of the horn writing, the French horn writing, everything. And the piano, of course, plays absolutely everything. In terms of the actual writing that was written for cello, there are two kind of cadenza-like, or not really cadenza, say recitativos, in the second movement, which are originally for one solo cello. So of course this is unchanged from the symphonic from the symphonic version. And of course these are fantastic moments, whether we are playing or listening to them. I mean they're unbelievable, but. Shostakovich, of course, had an incredible muse, as you say, and a very deep and close friendship with the great cellist Rostropovich, and of course, I mean, Rostropovich is largely responsible for most of the really great 20th century repertoire of the cello. He was the muse for so many important 20th century composers, and he premiered, I think, I don't know, hundreds of works in his lifetime. So. Of course, we cellists are very grateful and inspired by his example. And so I think he's one of the major reasons why so many of us are really interested in the music of our time to help create a really great 21st century repertoire.
Great. Well, when I think about this wonderful, ambitious piece, I did want to give a commercial for all of us in Aspen that in the past week we've had the Elliot Carter double concerto, we've had John Luther Adams's brilliant complex work, Sila, Frank Martin's Petite Symphonie Concertante, we have Frank Martin's concerto for oboe and harp coming up next week. And these, to my mind, are true festival pieces. They're very hard to program, especially this quantity of unusual repertoire. And we're just grateful to the artists who champion works like this and make it possible for us. Tell us about your tour. Where have you played so far, and where will you be?
We did two tours with this program with Schoenberg as well. One tour in Europe and one tour in the States. These happened during the season, so we went to London and Amsterdam and
Washington, Chicago.
Washington, Chicago, etc. So which I have to say was just, apart from the musical aspect of it, was one of the more fun tours I've ever done. Because I mean, when you think about it, a pianist doesn't normally get to tour with a group unless you're if you're touring with a chamber orchestra or an orchestra, that's one thing, but to tour the chamber group and have that camaraderie of 6 people touring together and going from one place to another and spending time together, it's just been such a ride. And then and so this summer is an extension of those two tours, where we're going here, obviously, and then after that we're taking, sadly, without Colin, because he has something called Edinburgh Festival. I've never heard of it. But they're coming. The rest of them are coming to La Jolla, to my festival, to play the Shostakovich, which I felt I could not program.
Okay, well, let's go briefly, or not briefly, as it happens, to Samuel Barber. As part of our Being American season, we did decide to have the three concertos of Samuel Barber as a sort of mid-century core of a certain kind of American repertoire that we wanted to represent. So if we start with Friday's piece with Enon, the Barber Piano Concerto, of the three concertos, this is the third that he wrote, and actually wrote it for the pianist John Browning, and it was given its premiere at the opening of what was then Philharmonic Hall, later Avery Fisher Hall, now David Geffen Hall. And it won the Pulitzer Prize in that year. And so it has some aspects of what one thinks of as a standard Barber concerto, a gorgeous singing middle movement, crazy moto perpetuo final movement, etc. But what are some thoughts of yours about the Barber concerto, and in particular its difficulty?
Oh, don't mention it. It is, I think, one of the most difficult concertos ever written, for both for the orchestra and for the pianist. It's fiendish in all the right ways. It's, I think, to my mind, stands at the same level as any of the great 20th century concertos of Prokofiev or Shostakovich or any of those. It's one of the great, great concertos that we have, and I do not for the life of me understand why it's not played more, because it's also incredibly... it grabs an audience, and that doesn't, from the very, very first moment, it does not let go. And it does have everything. I mean, the virtuosity and the excitement and the lyricism and this gorgeousness of the slow movement and this mind-boggling complexity delivered in a very approachable way. For example, the last movement is entirely in five eight. That's it. Thank you. 5/8. So you know, it's always 1-2-1-2-3, 1-2-1-2-3, 1-2-1, and very fast and very, very complex. And to get that together between us is always a challenge. But it is just staggeringly exciting. So I mean, for me, it's such a joy to be able to play that, and I don't get to play it as often as I want to, because a lot of orchestras go, well, it's too hard. And we were plagued by another, unfortunately, maybe it's me, but another cancellation, Alondra de la Parra, that was supposed to conduct it, unfortunately is not able to. So I'm very, very grateful to the assistant conductor here, who I just met with and has really kind of dived into this piece and adores it as much as I do, and I'm sure would do amazing things with it.
Yeah, we're really blessed this summer with our assistant conductor, who does a variety of things throughout the summer, but his name is Johannes Zahn. He is from Germany. And he said to me last night, I was thanking him for taking this on very short notice, and he had a big assignment last night in a concert. And he said, I think it's one of the greatest 20th century concertos. Other than Rachmaninoff, what would be greater? And I said, well, Shostakovich too, but who knows? there is a sweet story that John Browning, for whom the concerto was written, declared the last movement to be unplayable and asked for a revision, and Barber wouldn't do it until John Browning got Horowitz to read through it. And Horowitz called Barber and said, no, come on. and then he fixed it a little bit.
I can't even imagine what the unplayable version of it would be like, considering what the playable version is like.
Well, turning to the cello concerto of Barber, which Lisa will play on Sunday, it also is seldom played, also because of difficulties. I don't know if you can tell us about that.
Yeah, I mean, most of the things that Inon was talking about could very easily apply to the cello concerto. I mean, except for the 5/8 part. The last one is not in the 5. A few bars here and there, but it's... although I would say the level of, let's say, purely technical difficulty might be on par with the Prokofiev Sinfonia Concertante, which is also known for being fiendishly, you know, just have to practice a lot. But I also feel that it's an underappreciated, underplayed concerto that really deserves to take its place among the really great 20th century classics. It's also kind of interesting since... We seem to be more conscious of these things. It was written for a woman cellist, which is, you know, one great cello concerto, which was not written for Rostropovich, as we were talking about. It was written for Raya Garbusova, who actually happens to be the grandmother of the great pianist who is also very familiar to Aspen audiences, Jonathan Biss. So this is a really fantastic musical lineage there. And it was championed also by Zara Nelsova, who is also extremely familiar to Aspen audiences. Certainly when I was growing up, I studied with her a little bit. And so this is, you know, sort of nice fact. But it's also unmistakably Barber language with a very gorgeous, romantic second movement, which could easily... be in a 1940s film score. You could wonderful, very dramatic music, surrounded by fiendishly virtuosic and wonderful kind of jazzy rhythms in the first and third movements. But for Barber, I find this is a slightly grittier, certainly in comparison to the violin concerto, which is very romantic and very beautiful. For the most part, this is written in 1944. He was very conscious this was a wartime piece, and it's and of course you have the kind of general innocence in the language, which was very typical of Barber. But at the same time, there's a bit more anger, a little bit more resolve, a little bit more grit in it, I think, than some of the other music of that time from him.
So this is a very technical question. I did have the chance to meet Raya Garbusova myself, which is a very, very great person and very magnetic person. One can find the comment that she may have hurt the chances of the concerto with other cellists by her editing of it, and I didn't really understand that. Does that resonate with anything for you, or...? Just as a strange thought.
I don't know. You'd have to elaborate. I hadn't heard that.
So you have a version which is edited. Is it bowed by her? Is it?
Yes. Yes. And, it's yes. Yeah. And some of the bowings one can ignore as you would with kind of any edition. I mean, they're, you know, you take them into consideration. You learn them with them, but it's you have to ultimately find what is. What actually might practically work in some instances.
Okay. So, Inon, I don't want to give any other festival any support, but I do admire so much what I've seen of your plans for La Jolla, and why don't you tell us both some about that festival and what you're going to accomplish there, and then about this summer's program.
Thank you. It means a lot. This is my first season as music director, and like here, I like to have a certain thread go through the season so that there's a certain story. Of course, the season is less extensive than here. We have basically... It's 3 weeks, it's 15 concerts. But in searching for a theme or a thread that goes through my first summer, it occurred to me that
taking over a festival and is a challenge of trying to build something new at the same time as looking back at the past of what, and not breaking everything, but actually building on the past and taking it forward. And that composers have been doing that since the very beginning. It's how, and it emerges a theme of transformation. How do composers learn from the past? How do they, what is their relationship with the past? So, for example, in the first concert, I have a suite, kind of like a Baroque suite, but each movement is by a different composer, from arranging from Bach and through the Baroque and into the 20th and 21st century. And all these composers that looked back at the Baroque and took inspiration from the Baroque to write their own pieces. And so it's this ensemble is playing it as if it's one single piece, but you can follow almost the kind of the trajectory of how composers look back and at the same time look forward. And something like the Shostakovich Symphony, how composers look back at a lifetime of music, but also how another composer then takes it and transforms a symphony into chamber music, and so forth. So each concert has a slightly different slant on what that transformation means. But as a whole, as taking it, it's a kind of a journey of in, you know, back to the future. I should have called it Back to the Future.
Okay, well, thank you. That's the La Jolla Music Society's Summerfest, which is in La Jolla, because otherwise they would have called it something different.
Yes, and it's the first 3 weeks of August, which when does this festival end?
August 19th is our final concert, but we have Seraphic Fire and a Ken Burns event in the week following.
Yeah. So it competes. So thank you very much for the shout out.
Okay. Well, it's meaningful to us in that we were talking about Beethoven and the Ghost Trio being in the center of his works and representing both his middle period and also a transition into what we now understand as his final period. Naturally enough, Beethoven did not regard himself as having an early, middle, and final period, and did not regard most of his works as revolutionary, although there is a sort of political, social, artistic aspect of revolution that's explicit for some Beethoven. And he did remark about Opus 31, for instance, that at last I've done something completely new. But we, next summer, in the great Beethoven anniversary summer, and we will have all the symphonies, all the concertos, all the overtures, massive quantities of chamber music. But we will be thinking together about revolution and evolution and kinds of incremental change, and then looking at other composers throughout history, composers who are thought of as revolutionary, like Charles Ives or Monteverdi, but also composers who are much more evolutionary.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're absolutely right that Beethoven, we have this image of him, and we've kind of defined him very neatly and put him in this revolutionary box. But much of what he wrote was very much built on what came before.
Yes.
And also built on his what came before in his own work. So you could kind of it defies this easy categorization. I mean, some of the stuff he wrote in the Opus 2 sonatas is as profound and heart-wrenching as stuff he wrote in the last year of his life. Mm. So yes, you can certainly hear this. Late Beethoven becoming more and more, pushing the envelope more and more, and you can certainly hear this. What happens when a composer kind of retreats into their own mind in some ways and creates something that's in some ways unique and revolutionary, but in some ways the revolution of Beethoven is the strength of his personality more than breaking all the molds. It's this conviction of music making that grabs you the way that very few things do.
Alyssa, you want to agree or
No, completely. I mean, it's exactly as Zenon said, it defies categorization, and it was absolutely his individual force. Yeah.
And we're doing the over 2 years. We're in La Jolla. We're also doing all the string quartets, and each concert has early, middle, late. But you know, what does that mean? Each one of the late quartets is a totally different world, and you can't really. There is the Grosse Fugue, which is one of the most revolutionary pieces that he wrote or anybody else wrote, but as equally he substituted that movement in the late quartet with a very completely the opposite in some ways movement, you know, almost a jaunty. So, you know, we can't really, as much as we want to put him in a box, and that's one of the fascinating things about him. Do you get to play much Beethoven, Colin?
No, but fortunately, that doesn't prevent me from being a big fan of
Beethoven T-shirts at home.
Oh, absolutely, yeah, yeah. And actually, I wanted to ask you: do you play the piano trios very often? Because
yes.
Why? This is my question: why are they played relatively seldomly?
Are they relatively?
I mean, Archduke
yeah,
is played quite
seldomly,
a lot.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. I think a lot of Beethoven's pieces get eclipsed by his own pieces, especially the ones with titles. Even though the titles are more.
So you mean things like the harp and.
Archduke.
Razumovsky.
Archduke's Ghost.
Yeah, and Ghost Trio.
Okay.
The pastoral, you know, or whatever it is. The things that Pathetique Sonata. Is Pathetique Sonata yeah. that much greater than the ones before or after
Appassionata,
it?
Yeah.
Appassionata. Yeah, so I think it's a lot of the time the kind of the little. The title helps grab our imagination, and those pieces tend to, the Emperor Concerto, they tend to eclipse some of the other ones and rise to popularity. Whereas ones, I mean, it's not very sexy to say Trio Opus 3 number 1, you know, or whatever it is, you know, in Thieg Sharp. And I think in some ways he himself was a victim of some of those titles.
The other thing I think actually is also quite practical is that there are more established quartets than there are piano trios, and so Beethoven quartets get played very, very often. I mean, they're sort of a staple of quartet repertoire, whereas I mean there are not that many established piano trio groups with names.
But we're fortunate here because we've had the Wallersteins, but also David Finkel and Wuhan play the Beethoven trios all the time here.
Right.
They bring in a violinist.
Festivals,
you get it all the time,
yeah.
As you say. Yeah.
But, well, let's take a few moments and see if you have questions or comments in the audience. And if you do, please wait for a microphone. They're coming quickly. So right down in the middle, we have one.
Very inaccessible spot.
Yes.
It should work.
We can hear you.
Hello? Oh, sorry. I just have a funny comment. I saw the assistant conductor last night at the great Sarah Chang concert, and it was really fun to watch because he conducts almost with his expressions and his face as much as his hands. Mm. So it was really fun to see. So watch for that.
I wonder if he'll have time to do that in the barber.
Counting to five.
1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. Yeah. No, I'm looking forward to it. Yeah. We have a first rehearsal this afternoon. So.
Good. And here.
Colin, what are you playing in Edinburgh?
Oh, thanks for that. I have a very exciting project there, and actually, this is definitely an adventure. So I don't know if you know of the composer Sofia Gubaidulina. She's elder stateswoman of a particular type of avant-garde music from Russia. And she went through, I mean, she's 90 plus now, I think. So an elderly woman now. and went through much of what Shostakovich must have gone through and many of their other colleagues. Difficult times, challenging times as an artist, and you can certainly hear it in her music in a different way, perhaps, as you might hear it in Shostakovich's music. Partly because her music is a little bit more on the avant-garde wing, so it's slightly more elements of modernity. But this work is it's an amazing piece. I've never played it, actually, the first time, and it's a very modest title. It's called Glorious Percussion. And it's a concertante piece for five percussionists, so there are five soloists, and large symphony orchestra with, you know, huge brass section, four Wagner tubas. You know, it's a all bells and whistles, great festival piece.
Yeah, exactly. So, bring it to Aspen.
So, an amazing work, a very beautiful piece. But the title also, I think it is a piece that sort of looks at what percussion can do in terms of its, I would say, dignity and poise and power, because it's a very profound work, certainly very serious work, very beautiful, quite bizarre. It's definitely got some bizarro qualities, which I love, and a huge percussion, I mean, a massive, massive percussion setup. Tuned gongs alone, I think 40, 50 maybe. Antiphonal tuned gongs on either side of the stage, and then a huge mallet group, marimbas, vibraphones, surrounding the conductor, displacing the string section. I have no idea where they're going to go. But it's a unique opportunity to play this piece, and it actually will be the UK premiere of the work. Cool. So a great honour to play this piece. And very, very, very exciting to try and find all the tuned gongs. Yeah.
Well, we have two gongs.
Well, we're all in. We should talk.
Yes.
Let's get lunch.
Definitely. And actually,
do you have 50 of them?
Yes, well, exactly.
Actually, that piece would be perfect for next season. Asador Centurion has left the building, unfortunately. But as a sub theme to Beethoven, we're looking or we're commemorating the 100th anniversary of suffrage for women in the U.S. And so we're going to have a real exploration of this. And since Sophia is like practically 100 herself, that would be perfect.
This is great. Thank you so much. 10%. This 10%. We'll cut you in.
Get front row seats for next year's performance.
I have a very silly question. When it comes to a large piece of percussion, who decides plays what?
Well, in this case, it's my group, so I'm the boss, so I delegate. But it's an interesting question. In this piece particularly, there's a principal marimba part for sure, so I'll take that one. And then there are two players have to handle these gongs, which is quite a difficult task because they're so big. They're very unwieldy. So although they don't have to play fast melodies or something, the instruments themselves are huge. So it's a very difficult hand-eye coordination task. So I've got two people in my group who are kind of up for these sort of challenges. That's Catherine and Owen. So I asked them to do those parts. And then I'm very lucky. I've got two other players. Well, Sam's doing it, Owen, you'll remember as well. So two of my colleagues who played in this project or are in this project. So Sam is a very fine player in my group. I've known him since we're the same age, more or less. I've known him since we were 14 and 15, and he's a brilliant percussionist, very fluid. He's now a member of the London Symphony Orchestra, so he's going to play the other marimba part. So I just sort of piece it together, and we'll have fun with it. I mean, it's as a group, we've just got back from China. We had an amazing trip to Shanghai, and it's a great spirit in my group. Very positive. Everyone loves playing, and we play some wonderful music. We played a concert entirely of Steve Reich's music in Shanghai. Some of the first times that those pieces have been played in those places. It was an amazing experience. Audience were fantastic. A little bit rowdy at first, but really kind of frozen to their seats in the end. So it's fun. The percussion gig is always a fun one, as Inon will testify.
Yes, we tried our hand when we were... I have some wonderful videos on my phone of Elisa, Sergei, and myself trying our hand at the percussion section. It's not as easy
I've always wanted to do that. It's fun.
Okay, well, it has been a pleasure being with these guests today. Let me run through again performance opportunities. Tomorrow evening, 8 p.m. in Harris Hall, that's Thursday, Beethoven's Trio Opus 70, number 1, and Ralph Wallin's piece Four Marimbas, is it? And Shostakovich, epic performance of his 15th symphony. Then on Friday evening at 6 p.m., Aspen Chamber Symphony, Barber Piano Concerto with Enon. Then Saturday, 4:30 in Harris Hall, a Steve Reich piece for quartet of percussionists. And then Sunday at 4 p.m., Aspen Festival Orchestra and the Cello Concerto of Samuel Barber. Thank you to Elisa Wallerstein, Enon Barnaton, and Colin Curry.